of what we'd always known to be the reason for our power. Other than the name of our first Lord Governor, this information did not seem particularly significant. I kept looking. Eliana had requested material that covered several years, coming from a period both before and after Devris's ascension. I went back and forth through the documents, examining reams of tedium. I didn't know what I was looking for. Even if Eliana hadn't had a specific target, she would have been much better at this than I was. This was her domain, her battlefield. In the end, I found it. My eyes were glazing over by that point. I'd been there for hours. My head was beginning to throb. The record would have been easy to miss. But it was as if my hand were directed to hold the page and not let go until I read it and registered what it said. It was a query from the Office of a Surveyor. It requested a review of prior geological scans of the Malvale region to see where errors might have been made. Previous estimations of the composition of the hill showed no extractable value whatsoever. I stared at the parchment for several minutes, implications dawning on me. I looked some more and found a memorandum making brief reference to the request, stating that the matter had been closed. I carried on for another half hour, but there was nothing else. It was growing cold in the reading cell. The candles flickered in a faint breeze that had begun to breathe about me. One went out. The breeze touched the back of my neck like ice. I looked back and forth at the parchments I had found, reluctant to acknowledge the chronology that appeared before me. The land on which Malvale stood was worthless, and then it was valuable almost beyond measure. I looked at the exploitation license again, at the extraordinary range of riches that were found there. Gold, silver, iron, copper, all in one place. How truly fortunate. How gigantically improbable. No one had noticed this aberration except one person, and nothing had come of that. It was as if there were a balance. Everything impossible about the Strock riches was ignored as thoroughly as each governor was forgotten. This did not seem like a blessing from the Emperor. From somewhere, water dropped onto the document I held. It ran down the parchment like tears. "A pact," I whispered, repeating Eliana's word. A sob of despair answered me. I jerked up from the stool and stumbled away from the table. Eliana was there, sitting where I had been, her eyes fixed on the documents, her mouth open. She tried to form words, her hands raised, her fingers clenched like claws. Tears flowed down her face, and then she screamed, the wail rising and writhing in terror and grief. "Reach out! Give comfort!" I could not. Her scream was too huge, too overwhelming. There could be no comfort here. There was only horror. It filled the room. It filled my soul. Ashamed, gasping, I turned and fled. Behind me, the spectre of my wife screamed and screamed and screamed. Chapter 14. It was late when I returned to Malvale. I shut myself up in my chamber and sat in my bed, waiting for something, anything, to happen. I whispered Eliana's name again and again, calling to her, begging her forgiveness for having abandoned her once more. This time I would do better, I vowed. I would help her. How would I atone? How would I comfort the dead? What did I know about peace? I had lived nothing but war for most of my adult life. Now that I no longer took to the field, I felt even less peace than before. But I must help. If only I knew what had made her scream. What I had read in the archives disturbed me. It made me uneasy. I did not understand enough yet. That might have been a mercy. It was also one I could not accept. If I were to help Eliana, I had to know the reason for her horror. The hours of the night dragged by. She did not come. Nothing appeared. I was alone with my thoughts and my failures. I clutched my head. I wished I could tear the guilt from my mind. But all my thoughts were of guilt. I'd failed my troops and the Imperium on Clostrum. I'd failed Vice. I'd failed Eliana. I'd failed my children. How could I stop the failures? How could I protect my children? How could I protect those who could not protect themselves? What do you mean? They're adults. They're down below, sleeping. Oh, are they? And are they really? Really what? Are they really my children? I don't know these people. I'm told she is Katrin. I'm told he is Xander, and I accept that. They could be anybody. They look like your children. There is a resemblance. I may be seeing it because I expect to see it. If they aren't your children, who are they? Impostors? What? Not who? That is the question. What are they? Isn't it odd that they never react to the manifestations in this house? No one sees them but you. Perhaps. But it isn't just that. When I pound on their doors, they don't hear me. When I yell, they do not come. It is as if they aren't present at all. As if the only time they exist and sleep in their beds is when I am there to observe. The young children, little Katrin and Xander, they react. They know the danger. They turn to me for help. They love me. I keep trying to save them. I keep failing, but they're still safe. Somehow they're still safe. They burned in the fire. No, there wasn't a fire. I chased the arsonist away. There were no bodies. I will find them again. I will save them. I swear it, Eliana. Please come back to me. Please give me another chance. Where are the children? Are they all right? Then I remembered what year this was and how old I was. I brought myself up short. This is unhealthy. Stop indulging in these thoughts. Be careful of where they might lead. Everything led to failure, I thought. I spiraled down into the recrimination of failure again. The rest of that night, I tried not to wonder too much if Katrin and Xander were who they said they were, but the weed of suspicion refused to be uprooted. You look tired, Xander said to me in the dining hall the next morning. All three of us were there this time. I am tired, I admitted. That was half a lie. My arms and head felt so heavy with exhaustion that I could barely move them. Do not let the gossip rob you of sleep, Katrin said. It's not worth the cost. What gossip? I asked. There are whispers in the town that you killed Councillor Weiss or that you had her killed. Montfort, I muttered. This is her doing. She as much as told me this was what she would do. Only that wasn't entirely true, if I was honest. Montfort had not threatened to frame me. She had directly accused me of the murder. She could not seriously believe that I'd done it, especially since it was obvious that she'd orchestrated the murder. Unless she's mad. Perhaps she generally does not know what she's done. Then it's time. It took me a moment to realise I'd spoken aloud. Time for what? Katrin asked sharply. She would no more agree to killing Montfort than Rivas and Stavark had. Xander just looked confused and worried, but I could guess where he would stand also. They would not support me. There was no unity in this house. If they were really my children, there would be. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Time for what? Katrin asked again. Time something was done, I snapped. And thrown, I wish I knew what that was. I marched out of the hall before she could question me further. The last thing I had said was true, though. I didn't know how to counter Montfort. The idea that I should want Weiss dead should have appeared ridiculous to anyone capable of conscious thought. Montfort had the power to make truth and reason irrelevant. I could see how it would work. I could see what Weiss had been trying to tell me. Too many people were under Montfort's thumb. If she said something was real, they would echo and re-echo her until even those who were not in her thralls believed it. If Montfort said I had two heads, then that too would become the truth. I wondered if the militia also would accept Montfort's perverse truth. If enough of them were in her pocket, they would. Still, deposing me through arrest would not be easy, not with the Adeptus Arbites watching. Such a move could attract the wrong kind of off-world attention from Montfort. She might not be able or wish to get me that way. Nor would she have to. The more successful her rumour campaign, the more difficult my work would become. I couldn't see any way to fight back except through direct means. That was how I had fought every battle until now. My patience with everything else was badly frayed. As she drove me to the council hall for the day's session, Belzec said, "For what it's worth, my lord, the people behind these rumours should be punished." "Senior Councillor Montfort is behind them," I said, "but I suspect you guessed that." "I did, my lord. I hope you will silence her soon. The Montforts should not be permitted to blacken a Strock name like that." I grunted softly, surprised by revelation. There was the answer to the mystery of the Strock governor's obscurity. The Montforts had been at war with us ever since we had taken power from them. Their revenge had been to deny us a legacy. They whispered infamy against the memory of every Lord Governor Strock. They wove a tapestry of lies, used their influence to have it declared reality, and then they smothered our good name beneath it. "Silencing her would be my fondest wish, Belzec," I said, my heart's desire. But in this matter, I cannot act as my heart would have me do. Belzec was quiet for a few moments. When she spoke again, I sensed that she was choosing her words very carefully.
My lord, you are far from alone in your enmity towards the Montforts.
I'm glad to hear it.
Despite their power, they do not control every aspect of...
She paused.
Of the shadows on Solus. Do you understand what I mean by that?
I think so. Do go on.
There are some acquaintances of my acquaintances who are able and willing to undertake delicate tasks.
And how wide is the range of their work?
Very. I hope you don't mind my mentioning this, my lord.
I don't. In fact, I appreciate it very much. I looked out of the window musing. The vehicle nosed slowly through the crowded streets of Valgast as we made our way towards the city centre. The day was frigid. It had begun to snow. In spite of how much I wanted to see Montfort dead, Rivas's warning came back to me. I reminded myself that my duty was the restoration of Solus's honour, not pursuing a family vendetta. Ordering an assassination, even if it were successful, would be a betrayal of that duty. What I would most want to ask, I said, I cannot. Yet here was an opportunity for direct action, one I should not forego. There might be another way to come at Montfort. Is one of these acquaintances of acquaintances proficient at gaining access to difficult locations?
Yes, I know of one who is very skilled in precisely that field.
I would like to meet this person.
Is that wise, my lord? Perhaps I should act as an intermediary.
No, I said. I was conscious of the risk of making myself known to a third party, but I still needed to be inside selling myself. A thief would not know what to look for, because I didn't. I was sure I would know it when I saw it, though. Arrange a meeting, I said. I will be there in person. Silling was not isolated from the rest of the city in the same way that Malvale was. Yet with its defences, it might as well have been. Many of the councillors had their great houses just south of the city centre. The home of the Montforts, though, was much further south. Their fortress, and that was surely what it was, stood amidst Valgast's most squalid sector. This was where the disgraced, the criminal and the unwanted found their homes. The hablocks were foul and cramped. Some had been gutted by fire, but their hollow shells provided comfortless shelter from the winds and rains to the most desperate of Valgast citizens. I still had my las pistol and sword, and I brought my pistol with me that night. I had no intention of using it in Silling, but I might have need of its persuasive power in the streets outside. The grounds of the house were surrounded by a wall a good 15 feet high. Its gates were an impenetrable iron barrier and heavily guarded. From the street, the house was invisible. I met the thief a block away, in the entryway of one of the burned-out hablocks. The wind keen through the empty windows and echoed piercingly in the doorway. The thief was an old man. He called himself Tervine. His face was cross-hatched with deep lines. He moved with a fluid grace belying his age, and his eyes were sharp. He greeted me with a nod and a grin. There was no bowing to my status. He simply took me on as an equal partner of the shadows. I felt strangely flattered.
So, he said, Silling. There's a cap for the courier. There's a target I've been thinking about for a long time.
Why haven't you broken in before?
Needed an incentive to take the risk. Too chancy to do it on my own hook. Hoping to find what I can find, that's no good.
He shook his head.
Poor reason to stir up the Montforts.
I'm told you have no great love for them.
He snorted. Greedy hypocrites. They want everything for themselves. Those they can't control, they punish with the militia. That's not a fair game.
I sensed there was more than a matter of principle at stake. There was anger behind that smile. I think you have a personal debt to settle with the Montforts. He hesitated, then shrugged.
As well we know what's what, he said. I had a family once. I tried to play by the Montforts' rules. Their tithe got too big. We were hungry. I tried to keep back a little more on the side.
You were punished?
My family was punished. They weren't part of what I did. There was a fire. Just an accident of fate.
I've had one of those too.
Right. So we understand each other. Good.
We set out. The snow had turned back to sleet, and the street was covered in inches of dirt-blackened slush. The gate was on the north side of the wall, and Tervine took me to the west. We were alone on the street there. The buildings on the other side of the road were deserted rubble. There was no lighting. The only illumination came from the waxing crescent of Luctus, glowering through the clouds. We had to move carefully through the amber-tinged gloom. The wall was a featureless black mass beside us. Tervine stopped at a point 3/4 of the way towards the southwest corner. He checked that we were alone, then unshouldered the case he was carrying.
"Have to be sharp about this," he said. "There's a gap in the patrols, but it won't last forever."
"Careless of the Montforts to have one last this long."
"Are your grounds guarded?"
"Not particularly. There isn't a need."
"No," he agreed. "No one breaks into Malvale."
"Why is that?"
"Don't know exactly. Never heard of it being tried, is all. With Silling, it's clear why no one has tried. Who wants to go to war with the Montforts?"
"I do." Tervine chuckled.
"There you go. Takes a Lord Governor to do it."
From his case, he removed what I took to be a firearm. It looked like a crossbow with a very large magazine. He took aim up the wall and pulled the trigger. Twin bolts shot out, each pulling a monofilament lanyard. From the magazine came thin strips of flexible plasteel. The bolts struck home, and a nearly invisible ladder hung before us. Tervine scrambled up.
"Hold the steps, not the filament," he warned.
I did as he said. I preferred to keep all my fingers. Tervine's aim had been true in the dimness. We'd hit very close to the top of the wall. When we reached the top, he pulled the ladder up and dropped it over the other side. We climbed down into the darkness of the grounds. Silling rose before us. It was a grand manor house that embraced an iron tower at its centre, jutting more than 50 feet into the night sky. Tervine paused to reload his ladder gun.
"Been here before?" he asked.
"Never."
"You?"
"No."
He nodded at the facade.
"Not a subtle bunch, are they?"
They were not. The house's front was a riot of gold-plated sculpture. It glowed in the light that blazed from the ground-floor windows. A colossal aquila stood proudly over the main entrance, its wings so broad they extended almost half the length of Silling. There were statues, scattered about the grounds, and they were in keeping with the sculptures on the house. Even in the night, I could see they were all portraits of exemplars of faith. This was faith where ostentation mattered more than religion. The Montforts had managed to make a vice out of piety. There was something obscene about the detail of the martyrs' suffering, or the godlike heroism of the saints. All were rich in gold and embedded jewels. "You called them hypocrites," I said as we started walking again. "You were profoundly right."
"I can see it's going to be a pleasure working with you, Lord Governor."
He led me towards the southwest corner of the house. There was less light coming from inside at this end.
"So," he whispered, "now that we're here, where would you like to go?"
"Wherever they might keep their secrets." I knew Tervine was grinning at me in the dark again. I could feel it.
"Big house," he said. "Lots of places to look."
He was right to be amused. It would be one thing to come here with robbery in mind. A thief could remain flexible, grabbing whatever valuables came easily to hand. I was looking for something that was simultaneously much more specific and much more vague. "And yet," I said,
"I know exactly where we should start."
A single glance at Silling was all I had needed. We will be heading for the tower. It was a thin spire. The staircase inside would have to be a tight spiral, unless there was a vertiginous ladder to climb instead. The spike of its peak could only hold a single room, whose windows looked out on all sides. When the room was occupied and lit, I imagined that the windows would be dull, baleful eyes staring covetously at all of Valgast.
"Can you get us in there?"
I asked.
"I can. It will be the dizzy way in."
I thought it might be. As we drew closer to the house, we heard a scream from inside. I started. Tervine laid a hand on my arm to keep me still.
"We can't ignore that," I whispered. "It isn't what you think."
"What do you mean?"
"The victim is being paid."
"To do what?"
"To be a victim."
Tervine must have felt my stare. He tugged my arm. I pulled free and crept back towards one of the lighted windows. "Selling their services did not mean that they're agreeing to be tortured," I said.
"These ones do. Councillor Montfort and her family pay very, very well. I know. I've seen the wounds, and I've tried to get the injured to work against the Montforts. They won't. They're clever, the Montforts. They know exactly how far they can go, especially when it comes to going too far.
I reached the window. I stayed back, looking in at an angle. There was so much light in the room that I was invisible to anyone there, and they were too occupied to look outside. I could only see a bit of what was going on, but that was more than enough. I saw a heaving tableau of contorting, entwining bodies. I saw the tools and the iron frames that twisted flesh and produced the screams. I saw Montfort, rampant, the centre and presiding power of the twisted carnival. Her face turned towards the window for a moment, and I saw the awful coldness in her eyes, the perfect control in the midst of abandon. Tervin was right. Those were the eyes of someone who knew, down to the smallest nuance of sensation, exactly how far to go and no further. Tervin pulled at me again. Grimacing in revulsion, I turned away from the window and followed him. Trying to intervene for Montfort's slaves of the night would be worse than useless. Her corruption and debauchery were as finely tuned as her political acumen. Tervin stopped at the base of the mansion's wall. The windows above us were dark. There were plenty of noises coming from elsewhere in the house, deeper inside and muffled by the walls. It reminded me of the dark revels I'd heard coming from inside Xander's room, though there were differences. The nature of those differences was hard to define. There was something ordered in what I heard. It was cruelty with a system and purpose utterly devoid of chaos. Tervin fired the ladder gun again, launching much longer filaments this time, giving us the means to get all the way to the roof of the main structure. It had a steep slope, and we had to move carefully to keep our footing as we crept towards the base of the spire.
"What's the range of that gun of yours?" I whispered. "Not as great as we would like this night," he said.
He opened his case again and reloaded the magazine.
"What we've just climbed is about as long as I can make a single ladder, and I only have the material for two more."
"That isn't going to get us to the top."
"Not at a stroke, no. I did say this was going to be the dizzy way. We can turn around."
"No, we can't."
"Good. You go ahead of me this time."
He fired again, and we climbed again, getting about a third of the way up the side of the tower. A few rungs down from the top of the ladder, he hooked an arm through the rungs, held himself firmly in position, and fired once more. The bolt shrieked past me, struck home, and at the end of the new ladder, dangled just within reach of the top of the one I held. Impressed by Tervin's aim, I moved on. He stopped once he had hold of the new ladder, and dangling precariously, pulled up the first. Claws on the gun hooked the filaments, and he turned a mechanism, spooling the ladder back into the device. I watched the procedure, trying not to think about how things were going to be for our descent. I made myself look away when the ground began to spin. We climbed, and Tervin repeated the procedure. The awkwardness of the task did not seem to bother him. His movements were confident, the thief sure that he was not going to fall to his death. I was less certain. We kept climbing. I focused on the immediate task of moving from one rung to the next. My left arm ached with strain, and though the prosthetic grip of my right was firm, the lack of feeling kept making me doubt if I'd truly gripped the rung. At last, we reached the edge of the window. The ledge was just large enough for the two of us to haul ourselves up and crouch in the pointed arch of the recess. The window was clear glass steel. Tervin took a small plasma cutter out of his case and set to work. It was a slow process. The wind was strong this high up, and though it was blowing from the north and we were sheltered from its full fury, gusts kept reaching around the spire and trying to pry us loose from our perch. I gripped the edges of the sill, the fingers of my left hand growing numb. Impassive, Tervin worked away, cutting an outline that would be just big enough for us to squeeze through one at a time. He shut down the cutter.
"Ready?" he asked.
Before I could answer, he kicked the window. The central portion fell into the room beyond with a crash that seemed loud enough to be heard across Valgast.
"They won't have heard down below," Tervin said, "not with all the noise they're making."
The chamber we entered was a circular study. There was a bronze desk placed before each of the windows, giving a choice of commanding views. In the centre of the room was a throne on a mechanised dais. The walls between the windows were taken up by shelves crammed with scrolled parchments and leather-bound volumes. Now that we were inside, I became aware of the smell of the place. The stench was old and fresh, ingrained into the walls and floor, and clearly constantly renewed. It was the smell of sweat, of sex, and of pain. Blood, ancient and new, was present too. It was the stench of decadence. I grimaced in disgust that it should be so strong here, in a chamber clearly meant for observation. And then I wondered what terrible forms observation could take. From far, far below, the cries of the Montfort entertainment rose in sordid echoes up the tower stairs. "I should send the Inquisition here," I muttered.
"It would do no good," said Tervin. "You're not the first to have thought of that." "It's what I said. The Montforts know what they're doing."
"But such excesses," he shook his head.
"No, that's not the impression I got from the people I spoke to, the ones who appeared to take part. It's not excess, it's a kind of discipline."
Tervin sounded revolted and impressed at the same time. Then he produced a lumen torch and shone the beam around, being careful not to flash it past the windows.
"Well," he said, "the search is up to you, Lord Governor."
I grunted. I moved around the dark chamber slowly. There were documents scattered on the desks, but a quick glance showed that though they might be suggestive of malfeasance in the right context, they were not useful enough to justify the risks we were taking. Nor did what I saw on the shelves look promising. My goal was nebulous and frustrating. "I don't think what I seek will be left out in the open, even in here," I said at last. I glanced at the small door in the west hall of the study. Through it, we could descend to the rest of the house. And a search so large, it was doomed to failure. Tervin was examining the controls on the arms of the throne.
"Rotate left and right, yes, yes," he muttered. "But what about these? What are they for?"
He was focused on two small switches under the arms of the throne. He toggled them in turn, then at the same time. After a minute of experimentation, he triggered the correct combination. With the grinding of metal against stone, the throne's dais rose, becoming an iron column 5 feet across. A narrow doorway in its side opened onto a cramped flight of stairs that led down into a vault under the study. Tervin handed me the torch.
"I think whatever you'll find down there would not be healthy for me to know about, but if you see something an ordinary thief could use..."
"I'll make sure to take it," I promised. I descended into the gloom. The ceiling was so low I had to crouch. I was surrounded by oaken cabinets. I pulled drawers open at random. Some of the documents inside looked very old as the records I'd seen in the Administratum Palace. Others were more recent. All of them were written in cipher. I cursed. I opened the drawers faster, flipping through the documents I found, all handwritten, at different times by different people, all with meanings hidden from me. The only things that were not indecipherable were, at first glance, useless to me as well. They were copies of council records. They covered a wide variety of subjects, none of them sinister by themselves. It was only after I had seen what must have been a dozen of them that a pattern began to emerge. All of these documents concerned actions taken or edicts issued by the governing Strock. I saw names I'd never known, references to ancestors completely forgotten by history. Forgotten by everyone except the Montforts. Only our enemies appeared to have taken the proper care to preserve our history. I moved deeper into the vault, and behind the last of the cabinets, I found a long plasteel chest with a heavy padlock. I shuffled back to the stairs, got Tervin to pass down his plasma cutter, then returned to the chest. The searing glare of the cutter dazzled me, but I made short work of the lock. I waited until I could see properly by the light of the torch, then opened the chest. There was a portrait inside, very old. The name engraved on the bottom of the frame was Devrys Strock. He wore rich robes of blue and violet, green and red. They were not the vestments of a planetary governor. At first I assumed the portrait had been done before his ascension. Then I saw that he held the rod of office in one hand and a sword in the other, as if announcing what was or what would soon be his. There was no doubt this was a Strock. The sharp, slightly elongated nose, the narrow eyes, the high, rather heavy forehead. The family characteristics were strong, recognisable over the span of centuries. There was an arrogance in his gaze that I did not like, a defiance and hunger that were not, I fervently wished to believe, the dominant traits of our house. And all of this was nothing. It was not the expression in the portrait that hit me with the force of a physical blow and had me staggering back, yet at the same time held my gaze with an unbreakable lock. Runes surrounded Devris. They crawled up and down the periphery of the painting. They writhed and tangled with each other like serpents and insects, though they were infinitely fouler. I did not know what any of them meant. They were monstrous, though, unholy. They were mere shapes, and they were abominations. Such contortions of lines could not exist. And here they were, a heresy so monstrous it exceeded my sense of what was possible in all the possibilities and permutations of degradation. They attacked my gaze with their angles. Their illusion of movement sank claws into my soul. I was endangering myself just by looking at them. Ignorance could not protect me for long. The worst and largest of the runes was an eight-pointed star. In the simplicity of its shape, by comparison to the rest of the terrors, it was familiar in some hideous fashion. Though I'd never seen it before, it seemed to whisper to me, as if it could conjure unspeakable thoughts, urges and desires from the deepest well of my psyche. It knew me better than I knew myself. It would show me such wonders if only I gave myself to it. Horror was my salvation. It made me cling to my faith with a death grip. The star took up most of the width of the portrait. It was in the background, behind Devris, though the circle that surrounded the arms of the star appeared to embrace him at the waist. Ancient as the painting was, the eight-pointed star glistened. If I touched it, I would be tainted. With a groan of effort, I tore my gaze from the painting and slammed the lid of the chest down. I sank down against a cabinet, gasping for air. The words Eliana had written swirled through my mind like acid, like cancer. The pact, the pact, the pact. There were things here that I did not understand, and I must never do so. There were others, less dangerous, but agonizingly painful, that I had to confront. Tervin was wrong. There had been at least one robbery at Malvale. There was no question in my mind that this was a portrait Devris had commissioned. The creation radiated pride of the worst kind, and at some point, the Montforts had acquired it. Why haven't they used it? The potential for blackmail was enormous. I shuddered at the thought of what would happen if that portrait of blasphemy fell into the hands of the Inquisition. Would all the virtue and piety and duty that had been the hallmarks of the House of Strock since Devris matter in the least? Maybe they would. Maybe the unswerving faith of my family had been an unconscious effort to atone for a crime we could not remember, but from which we continue to benefit. A pact. I saw what Eliana had deduced. I understood her agony that continued past death. Devris had entered into a pact with powers I could not comprehend, though I could see they were beyond unholy. He had been given the impossible riches beneath Malvale, and through them, the governorship of the planet. What did he give in return? His allegiance, to judge from the portrait. But what did his allegiance mean? What was the cost? No direct heirs. Let's start there. Terror for my children threatened to choke me. Was that part of Eliana's pain, too? It wasn't just peace that I'd tried to grant her. She needed salvation. We all did. We needed to be rescued from what Devris had done. I did not know how to save us. Perhaps Eliana did. She kept pointing the way for me as best she could. Together, we could save our family. I clung to that hope. It was a thin one and fragile. It was also enough to give me the strength to struggle back to my feet. I stared at the chest. I dreaded opening it, but I could not leave that painting intact. It was more than the danger it represented in Veth Montfort's hands. It was an unclean thing. It could not be permitted to exist. I braced myself, then moved to the chest. It seemed to radiate cold now. It was a monstrous thing itself, corrupted by the evil it held. In a rush, before I could hesitate, I flung the lid back, ignited the plasma cutter, and trained its beam on the painting. The beam shut off. I tried to restart the burn. Nothing. The cutting tool was dead. I brought the lid of the chest, crashing down before the painting seized my gaze and started gnawing into my soul again. I rushed back to the stairs, banging into cabinets. The vault was closing in on me. The spider at its centre wanted to haul me back. I lunged up the stairs, back into the study. The degraded stench of the house seemed almost banal now, compared to what I had seen. "Was there anything?" Tervin began. Then he saw my face. "We should go," he said. We fled. The vertiginous descent from the tower was as nothing. I had just fallen infinitely further. Chapter 15. I will never leave this house again. This is not a determination, it is a fact. This is my prison. Malvale sent me out one last time. Now it will keep me. Earlier, I tried to leave again. I did not want to go. Though the house wishes me ill, the thought of leaving was intolerable. Because of that, I knew I had to try. My terror of the outside world might not be mine. I don't know how many of my thoughts are my own and which belong to the house. Even this journal. No matter how much I whisper to myself, I find other words here that I do not remember writing. There is so little that is mine anymore. I was in the librarium. I was sitting down, looking out at the window. I was as comfortable as a prisoner can be, but I resent this prison. So I vowed to shake the bars and try to leave of my own volition, not the house's. I reached the front door. I called for Karoff. He did not appear. I looked into the dining hall, searching for one of the serfs. I could hear them in the house. I wanted someone to be with me. I hoped that might give me the strength to go outside. I could not find them. Their distant voices were lies. I do not believe the serfs are really here. I think they have abandoned me too. They're just pretending they have not. I am alone. I think, in truth, I always have been. I opened the door. I stood on the threshold. I could go no further. I tried to lift my foot, to take a single step. I could not. It was as if adamantine shackles held me where I was. It was windy. The dead trees near the house looked like they were nodding. They were mocking me. There were figures in the trees and partway down the hill. They were indistinct. The ones in the trees were not moving. They were half hidden behind the trunks. They were staring at me. They were grey and they were hollow. Their eyes were dark. But if I had been close enough to look into them, I would have gazed into empty skulls. They were shells, here but not here, a walking lie, just like the serfs. Or perhaps not. Perhaps they were more real. Perhaps they were the truth. The serfs only wanted me to think they were there. The figures on the road to the house were harder to make out. They moved back and forth, purposeless. They were trapped, like me. The wind grew stronger. I wanted to go back inside. The house had won. I surrendered. I did not wish to see these figures any longer. Malvale would not let me go. It was teaching me a lesson. I had to be punished for my willfulness. As the wind howled, I was terrified that it would develop a voice. I needed to shut the door against the wind before it began to speak. I couldn't cover my ears. I couldn't close my eyes. There was movement at the edge of my vision. I stared straight ahead. I must not turn my head and look. I must not see. The wind found its voice. It came from underground. It came from the open mouths of the mining tunnels. They were the throats of something vast. I heard the first notes of a terrible choir. I screamed. I screamed to drown out those voices. I failed, but Malvale must have been satisfied with my terror. It released me. And at last, I could shut my eyes and I could move. I rushed inside and slammed the door. I trembled in the entrance hall for a time. The voices scratched at the door. When I moved into the dining hall, they followed, hurling themselves at the windows. The panes rattled and the choir sang just at the edge of my hearing. If anyone else had been with me, they would only have heard the keening of the wind. But there was no one else. There never has been. I wandered through the house, purposeless as the figures on the hill. When I heard the voices of the empty shells pretending to be serfs, I hurried in another direction. I was done with illusions, and I was frightened. I moved through the rooms of debris. After all the work that had been done, none of the heaps looked any smaller than when I first arrived. Of course they aren't. All is pretense. There was something different, though. Now, when I paused near a pile, I easily found records and journals left by the previous inhabitants. I am a prisoner, just as they were. There will be no secrets for me any longer. No, that is not true. There will always be secrets in Malvale. No matter how many revelations there are, no matter how much I learn to my cost, there will always be more. I am reading the journals and the letters and the desperate scrawlings that I have found. I am no longer making a history of the family. I am living its curse. But I read because what else can I do? One of the secrets is a figure who sets the building on fire. Generation after generation of Strock lords see this figure, sometimes male, sometimes female. The fire that it sets is always an illusion. It vanishes with the arsonist. The governors feel mocked by it, though they can never see its face. They always pursue it, and it always escapes. So that is a secret. If any of them have discovered who the figure is, they have not set it down in writing, or at least not in the bounty of dark writings Malvale has exposed me to. Enough of these histories of terror. Enough of Malvale's torment. I must cut the strings on which I dangle. Enough of everything. I see what I must do to force a crisis. I will wait until the pretense of the serfs ends, and then I will act. I failed. And now I have seen the arsonist too. I have seen more than that. I have seen worse than that. I started to discard my past days ago. Now it is time to finish the task. I understand it better now. The past is foul. It is dangerous to anything I might still hold dear. I must bury it. I must add my small efforts to stamping down upon it. The burying can never stop. What rises does not rest. Its hunger is eternal. Before dawn, I answered the call to the old tower. I have resisted as long as I could. Until recently, I did not know I was resisting. Unconscious fear kept me away. I have gone, though. I descended. I have learnt something new. It is possible to have a renewed purpose and know the greatest despair. I have learned too much. I have seen. I know, Mason. I saw, and I know. This should be your burden. I cannot carry it any longer. From a great distance, I watched myself go through the motions of the day. My body attended council. My spirit was far away, trapped in the vault in Silling Spire. My mind roved back and forth between them, agonizing over the implications of what I had seen and what might happen now. How long it would be before Vethmont IV discovered the broken window, and from there the broken padlock on the chest. She would guess that my agents or I had been there. She would know I knew what she had. She'll have to act soon. I would have to in her position. Act how? That was the only reason I was able to pay any attention at all to the council session. I managed to avoid staring directly at Montfort. I did what I could to observe her actions and her allies too. I tried to divine what they meant. I was looking for auguries that would tell me when the storm would break and how. I was no wiser at the end of the session than I had been at the start. There were manoeuvres to delay the production reports. That side of the war seemed a mere distraction now. If Montfort destroyed me, the campaign against corruption would end. I had no faith that Xander would continue my fight or that Catherine would urge him to. The promises we'd made to each other felt empty. I kept having to suppress doubts that I'd been speaking then to my actual children. I was sure Montfort saw our overt struggle in the same way. If she was fighting to preserve her empire of crime, it was for the larger end of destroying the Strocks. I spoke out against delays, though I barely paid attention to my own words. Montfort remained impassive throughout. She did not look like someone who was being forced to take precipitous action. I was wrong. She must have discovered what we did, and she isn't worried. She has the whip hand, and she knows it. When the session ended, I was filled with even greater dread. I had Belzec wait when I left the council hall. I crossed the square to the cathedral. I stopped just inside, looking down the length of the nave and up at its majestic heights. I was alone in the vastness of the sacred space. Speak to Calvin. You must. You can't put it off any longer. Only I did. The Emperor did not grant me the spiritual strength to seek out my friend. I let anxiety convince me to delay a bit longer. What will he say about what I found? He is my friend, but he's also a cardinal of the ecclesiarchy. I know what his duty is. There's no question there. Delay, then. Give Montfort the opportunity to speak with him first. You will deserve what happens. But if she was going to reveal the existence of the portrait to him, wouldn't she have done so already? The time might not have been right. The stars may have aligned for her thanks to our efforts. What Montfort planned to do was irrelevant. My moral duty commanded that I walk down the nave in the direction of the vestry. Instead, I turned around and crossed the square once more. The light was failing when Belzec turned through the Malvale gates. The days were growing shorter as winter fastened its grip on Valgarst. "Night is falling early," I muttered. Belzec heard me and assumed I was speaking to her.
"Not as early as it will in 2 days, my lord."
"In 2 days?"
"The eclipse, my lord."
"So soon," I said. I'd been too long away from Solus. I'd forgotten about the eclipse. That would have been impossible if I still had the habits of a native son of the world. I would have been bracing myself for the event. Luctus would pass in front of our star in the hours before sunset. It was so large it would blot out the light completely, and night would fall early, with the suddenness of an executioner's blade. It was a hard darkness, and the reminder made it loom ahead of me like a grim monument. I would speak with Rivas before then, I promised myself. I must not look up into that deep night with my conscience so troubled. I saw Karoff on the grounds again, at the entrance to a different mine tunnel. He was just as motionless as before, oblivious to the frigid drizzle. We passed by some of the other serfs too, also motionless. They were all hard to see in the twilight. Twice I was about to call Belzec's attention to their presence, and both times the figures disappeared before I could utter a syllable. I even caught a glimpse of a young Xander and Katrin. They too were still, though their heads turned to watch us. They were standing on the slope of a crane's fallen arm. I felt a clutch of anxiety. They could so easily fall and be hurt. I was failing them. Then we were past, my children vanishing into the deepening grey of the twilight, and I was working hard to remind myself that they had not been real. The doubts were strong. I wondered if the effort to see them as apparitions instead of real children in need of my help was not part of the insidious plan of the adult impostors. I was braced at least for Karov's appearance at the house, and was not surprised when he opened the door to admit me. "Have my children returned?" I asked him. I decided, provisionally, that he was real. He seemed solid enough. He answered when I spoke to him.
"They have not, my lord," he said. "They have sent word that they will not be returning until late."
"Did they give reasons?"
"Your daughter has duties that are detaining her. Your son said he had an appointment with friends."
"I see. Likely reasons both.
Too believable. They're avoiding you."
I could not blame them, even though I did. I thanked Karoff and went to the dining hall. Serfs had my meal waiting for me. I sat at a table that seemed longer and emptier all the time. The clink of my silverware against dishes was the tiny sound of a pebble falling into a deep well. I brooded. My thoughts had no lack of dark subjects to orbit. I thought about Montfort. Now that I was back in Malvale, though, it was Eliana's journal that preoccupied me more. There was a growing overlap between our experiences. She had only seen darkness in this house. I admitted that there was danger here. Pretending otherwise would be fatal. The revelations in Siling had imposed a new weight of duty on me. I must fight to expunge Devris's crime. How? How will you purge the shadow of what he has done? I ate, but tasted nothing. I didn't notice when the serfs cleared the table. I had a vague sense of Karoff wishing me good night. I'd been alone in the house for some time when I finally rose and took a proper account of my surroundings again. I knew what I had to do. Eliana's journal had showed me the way again. Though there was only darkness in what I was managing to decipher, there were lessons to be drawn. There was duty to follow. It might lead to salvation. Eliana had realized that she had been avoiding the old tower. I had been too. I'd looked in it briefly. It held the most extreme of the piles of discards. The serfs had been working on the chambers on the ground floor and in the west wing of the second floor. They had not touched the old tower. I was as sure of that as I was sure that it was night. The soul turned away from the old tower. The mind sought to pretend it did not exist. I saw that this was what I'd been doing, and that understanding removed the excuses to avoid it. I headed for the tower, lighting every candelabra as I went. Where light could be, I summoned its presence. It was a welcome ally. It was also a weak one. When I reached the door of the old tower, shadows were reaching around me and pooling at the threshold. They refused to be banished. I waded into them and opened the door. Inside, the frozen cyclone of debris awaited. I carried a lumen torch, and when I shone its beam at the discards, it was terribly narrow, the merest splinter of light. I could see better than I had before, though. And there were no windows. It made no difference to come here in day or night. It was the home of darkness. Eliana had gone down. I would too. I started down the stairs, the cold breeze leeching warmth from my body. The steps had been rounded and made uneven by use and time. Their shapes were strange. I would have expected the worn depressions in the middle of each step, caused by centuries of ascending and descending feet. Instead, there were depressions on one side or the other, sometimes both. Some steps looked as if a huge mass had depressed one end into the stairs below, the rockcrete behaving with sudden molten properties. I had to walk slowly. I almost lost my footing several times. The surfaces were as slippery as if they'd been coated in slime, though they were dry. I pictured myself falling and rolling down and down and down the staircase, breaking bones, coming to lie broken and helpless in the abyss below. There I would await death, an echo of the shattered remains of Eliana. It would be a long time before I would be found. I might never be. I would disappear, swallowed by the old tower and the secret it held. Whatever Devris had done, it had been done here. As I descended, stopping on each step to steady myself, I played the torch on the pile beside me. As slow as my progress was, it was enough to create the illusion of movement. The vortex of objects seemed to be spinning slowly, rising from the far depths, like some terrible engine starting to life in the heart of Malvale. The further down I went, the more the cyclone drew and held my gaze. I had to pause even longer on each step. I had to make a deliberate effort to look where I was going. And though I kept staring at the grandiose waste left by my ancestors, I saw nothing of use. Eliana had made it sound like the secrets of Malvale offered themselves up to her gaze here when she finally looked. They were hiding from me. I judged I had descended as deep as the cellars in the newer portions of the house, and still had far to go when I saw movement. Real movement, not an illusion. A small, thin, graceful waving in a breeze that could not exist. I drew closer, cold sweat breaking out. I saw the beautiful traceries, the rich scarlet against deep blue, the distinctive colouring of the Pataka bird's plumage. Vice's headdress. The breeze gusted, buffeting the headdress, almost knocking me off my feet. It was as strong and brief as a harsh bark of laughter, and then it subsided. The headdress sat on top of an upended bureau. I reached out slowly, half expecting and half hoping that it would vanish as soon as I tried to touch it. The feathers brushed against my fingertips, their touch inexpressibly gentle and lonely. My breath hitched, a sob caught in my throat, hard and painful as a stone. My hand closed convulsively around the headdress. I pulled it from the heap. A narrow crust of dried blood was rough against my palm. Vice had come to Malvale when she had said she would. She had died here. Malvale, or the force that lurked within it, had killed her. I headed back up the stairs. I fought the urge to run. I was no longer tempted to look at the heap, though the cyclone continued its pretense of turning in my peripheral vision. I took the steps carefully, moving as quickly as I dared. The darkness below was an open maw at my back. My shoulder blades ached with tension, anticipating the pain of a blow, of teeth, of something worse. The exit was so far away. For too long, it was behind the curve of the vortex, and I could not see it. I feared I would be here forever, caught and damned by the spiral. I did reach the exit, and the old tower released me. It had struck its blow for the night. I hurled the door shut, and the boom of its closing resounded through Malvale like cannon fire. I could run safely now, though only a fraction of the candles I had lit were still burning. I rushed through the emptiness of the house, making for the illusory safety of my chambers. There was a heavy knock, a single blow on the main doors just as I reached the entrance hall. It sounded as if a large branch had been hurled against the house. I paused, panting and confused, then opened the door. Tervin was there. I was surprised he was strong enough to knock with such force, and I was surprised to see him at all. I had paid him last night. "What is it?" I asked.
"I need help," he said.
He spoke without inflection.
"What help?"
My grip on the headdress tightened. I prayed he was about to prove Belzec wrong about his character and try to blackmail me. Instead, he repeated himself.
I need help.
His voice was barely above a whisper. His unblinking eyes stared right through me. He kept twitching, jerking back and forth so quickly he was almost blurred. Spasms of pain shook his face. A grimace, horribly wide, flashed across his features and was gone. Show me, I said. He walked away from the mansion. I followed. The rain had become a fine mist. It coated my face in an instant, chilling me. Tovin walked slowly, yet I could not keep up with him. He was jerking more and more violently, as if he were being pulled in two directions at once. I still carried the lumen torch, its beam weak in the damp night. I could hardly see Tovin beyond the beam, and he seemed to float just above the ground, his staggering, erratic steps carrying him further than they should. The more I struggled to keep up, the more distance there was between us. He never vanished from my sight, though. He walked about halfway down the hill, then turned off the drive and moved between the giant iron skeletons of digging equipment. He turned again, going back up the hill at a short distance. I kept having to look away from him to pick my way over stones and rusting girders. He stopped a few dozen yards from the entrance to a mine. As I hurried over to him, I tripped and fell. When I picked myself up, filthy with muck, he had disappeared. I kept going. There was something in the cavern's mouth. All I could see at first was a confused silhouette, a fusion of jagged lines with a softer mass at its centre. I was only a few feet away when the torch beam fell on Tervine's body. He had been pierced by spears of stone. They had emerged from the walls of the cave, a few inches thick, and running from roof to floor and wall to wall. They were a web, impaling Tervin a dozen times. They split his torso open. Viscera had slid down the lengths of stone to hang just above the cavern floor. His head was ripped in two. The lower jaw was 5 feet from the upper skull, dangling from a spur that had pierced him on a diagonal. There was nothing remotely possible about anything I saw. The stone spears fused seamlessly with the edges of the cave mouth, as if the configuration had always been there, and the corpse had grown around it like moss. The ground was covered in blood. The drizzle was slowly diluting it. Streams ran down the incline into the cave, feeding the thirst of the mine. Tervin had just died, and he had been here forever. I could not guess how he had come to be here. Perhaps he had wanted to see me. Perhaps he had been lured. Perhaps he had walked in his sleep. How he had come to be here did not matter. This was what Malvale could do. It could kill whom it pleased, then show its handiwork to me as its pleasure. Chapter 16. I could not go back to the house. I went downhill, growing numb in the chill of the drizzle. I had a single purpose. Speak to Calvin, confess to him, tell him everything, and tell him now. The foolishness of my delay bordered on the heretical, but even now I wasn't sure if I would have done things differently. Eliana still needed to be saved. I couldn't save her alone. Things moved in the darkness around me. The shapes were indistinct and vanished whenever I looked to see what company I had. I saw Tervin again, not long after I'd rejoined the road. He came gradually and smoothly up the hill, his haunted eyes staring in the direction of the site of his death.
I need help, he said.
The words a toneless, mindless refrain.
I need help. I need help.
He walked on and disappeared. He passed me once more a short distance away from Karov's gatehouse.
I need help. I need